In the year before America learned the name Osama bin Laden, the Saudi was a disturbing, enigmatic presence in the world of terrorism. In Washington, bin Laden's fingerprints could still not be discerned definitively on any significant act against the United States or American citizens. But there was growing alarm about al-Qaeda's activities and the company it kept. Throughout, Iran remained the counter-terrorism community's top concern. Tracking Tehran's undercover activities and jousting in the dark with the Iranian intelligence services occupied much of Washington's energy. Yet bin Laden was steadily becoming the subject of more scrutiny and apprehension. Around Christmas of 1997, the White House decided that the threat posed by al-Qaeda had grown enough that it began pushing executive branch agencies to increase their efforts to disrupt the network. Bin Laden's fatwa of February 1998, Jihad Against Jews and Crusaders, a much briefer, more powerful statement than the one from 1996, caused an immediate stir when it was published in the London Arabic language newspaper Al-Quds Al-Arabi. Its language was determined, direct, and redolent of the Quran. In the months that followed, bin Laden gave more interviews, and a recruitment video circulated around the Islamic world. Beginning in May, meetings were held at the White House on possible action that could be taken against the Saudi. But the obstacles were forbidding. The United States had no indictment of bin Laden, and thus could not bring him to America for trial. No other country wanted custody of him, and there was nothing like a workable plan. At the same time, in the intelligence reporting, there were curious, coded statements that were ambiguous. It was impossible to know what, if anything, bin Laden was up to. The answer came on August 7, 1998. The Situation Room staff, people detailed from the military and intelligence community who route diplomatic cables, phone calls, intelligence reports, and messages to White House officials, roused the members of the Transnational Threats Directorate in the early morning. Gathered in a conference room in the West Wing basement, they went into permanent session with their colleagues from half a dozen different agencies to work out rescue coordination, an intelligence review, and defensive countermeasures. The initial crisis management work lasted for several days, with staffers napping on couches when they could or going home for short breaks. But amid the nonstop information-gathering phone calls, cable writing, briefings of White House officials, and cajoling of other agencies to move faster, they could not stop glancing at the CNN images on the monitors. In the mountain of tangled rebar, concrete, and glass in downtown Nairobi, the staticky telephone reports of carnage in Dar es Salaam and the seemingly endless procession of the injured, they saw something qualitatively different from anything that had gone before. No previous terrorist operation had shown the kind of skill that was evident in the destruction within 10 minutes of two embassy buildings separated by hundreds of miles. Someone at the time was quoted as saying that two such attacks were not twice as hard, they were 100 times as hard, and that true statement reverberated through the air for weeks. The days after the embassy bombings brought a mixture of successes and setbacks. The determination that al-Qaeda was behind the attacks came quickly. A fax claiming responsibility was found on a publicly used fax machine in London, and there was a sudden spike in phone traffic between organization operatives. At the same time, the slow start to the search and rescue effort in East Africa was an embarrassment. An Israeli team was first on the ground, freeing victims from the rubble. The official U.S. aircraft that was to bring a rapid reaction team of law enforcement, intelligence, and diplomatic officials broke down in Europe. American search and rescue teams had trouble finding planes to get them and their gear to Africa. The FBI's first group of agents did not arrive until 2 days after the blast. The pieces of the conspiracy quickly fell together. Mohammed Sadiq Ode was arrested when he arrived in Karachi from Nairobi on the day of the bombing, carrying a Yemeni passport whose picture did not match his face. Doctors in a Kenya hospital noticed that Mohammed Rashid Daoud Alawali had wounds on his back that suggested he was running from the bomb when it exploded. Wadi El-Hage was picked up by the FBI on September 15th in Arlington, Texas, and Khalfan Khan Mohammed was found in South Africa using the same alias he had in Tanzania. Some of these men talked at great length, spelling out how the plot was executed and who was behind it. Bin Laden's involvement was clear. These successes, however, did little to quell fears that more attacks were coming. In the face of the damage done in East Africa, the White House decided that it was imperative to disrupt the terrorists' operations and preempt possible attacks, including through military means. Action needed to be taken quickly. In the intelligence take after the bombings, credible reporting showed that other al-Qaeda conspiracies were nearing completion. The White House felt a sense of real urgency, because after the performance of August 7th, there could be no doubting that al-Qaeda might be ready to strike at any time. More unsettling, there was a fear that sometime soon the group would attempt something far more devastating than truck bombings.